Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and today we're focusing on global climate justice. What is it? Are we anywhere near achieving it? And if not, what needs to change? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. We're returning this week to the topic of climate change. You may have heard our episode a few weeks ago exploring global climate governance. Well, this week we turn our attention to global climate justice. The climate crisis has been caused mostly by the rich countries of the old industrial world, but many of the effects of that crisis are being felt first and most harshly elsewhere, in countries that bear little responsibility and often lack the resources to adapt. So what would a just response to the climate challenge look like? How close have past rounds of international climate negotiations come to that? And how are things looking for the COP26 climate summit taking place in Glasgow in November? Few questions can be more important than these, and joining me to discuss them are three people who have thought about them very deeply. Dr. Simon Chin Yi is lecturer teaching in international development here in the UCL Department of Political Science. He works on climate change, conflict, and vulnerable populations, particularly in Africa, and he has many years' experience as a consultant for UNESCO. Dr. Lauren Gifford is postdoctoral research associate in the School of Geography, Development and Environment at the University of Arizona. She works on global climate change policy and justice, asking how and by whom climate and conservation policies are enacted. And she advised the Fijian delegation in the run-up to the Paris Climate Accord of 2015. And Dr. Jessica Omukuti is postdoctoral research associate in the Interdisciplinary Global Development Centre at the University of York. She works on climate justice, climate finance, climate change adaptation and sustainable development in developing countries. And she has much experience working on climate change governance with international development organisations in the Horn of Africa. Simon, Lauren, and Jessica, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics. It's great to have all of you here. And can I ask each of you first, how would you actually define the concept of climate justice? Lauren, do you want to start?
I think we need to think about climate injustice before we think about justice. So I consider climate injustice the fact that those who have contributed least to climate change are feeling and experiencing its impacts first and most acutely. And this, you know, in the context of the UN, we talk about it country to country, but I think we also need to think about climate injustice across scales, from region, you know, the global south, less developed countries are experiencing the impacts of climate change first, with sea level rise and wild weather patterns or unpredictable weather patterns, but also the cost to adapt to climate change for heating and cooling and things like that. So we need to think about it both at the country scale, but also local scale, even the scale of the household and the individual. And climate injustice is ubiquitous and people are experiencing it all over the world in very different ways.
Thank you for that. Very good start. Simon, would you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I mean, you built on it at the beginning, Alan, and Lauren just touched on it as well. It's just looking to safeguard the most vulnerable populations by sharing both the burdens, but also the benefits of climate change and its impact on equality and fairness. A concept that actually is used within these climate negotiations for the past 20 years, that being the notion of common but differentiated responsibility and respective capabilities, and understanding how these vulnerable populations will and do and are reacting to climate change, and then who is particularly responsible for the current state of affairs, and then who should be in charge of paying for it.
A crucial question. Jessica, how would you define climate justice?
Thank you, Alan. For me, climate justice, it's very much linked to what Lauren and Simon just mentioned. So it's about allocating the, you know, responsibility and burden for causing climate change, but also for rectifying it. And specifically, I think for rectifying it is important where we think about how our countries or communities, as Lauren mentioned, how are different members of our communities affected by climate change. And so for adaptation to climate change, I think climate justice means first ensuring that those who are particularly vulnerable to climate change, but who have done very little to contribute to it, are sufficiently supported to, you know, to respond to the increasing climate change risks through, you know, provision of knowledge, technology, capacity, and finance. But also second, climate justice for adaptation means that we ensure that those who are vulnerable benefit from the support that is offered, because there's a chance that when this support is offered, it's, you know, it will go to sectors or populations that are not really affected as much, that are or that are not particularly vulnerable. And so climate justice means that these responses should actually reduce the vulnerability of populations, as opposed to doing nothing, or in some cases, you know, increasing this vulnerability.
So it sounds like you're all saying that there are kind of two dimensions to climate justice here. One is to do with vulnerability and the fact that those who are vulnerable to the actions that we take in order to address climate change need to be protected in some ways. And another is to do with responsibility, that there's just a differential amount of responsibility for climate change in the first place, and that needs to be taken into account in all of this. Simon, you wanted to come in.
I just wanted to add on to what Jessica just said, because I think it's a really important point that that when you're looking at these different vulnerable populations, that we actually focus in on and actually pay attention to countries that have least capacity in these contexts. For example, if you think of some of the Central African countries like Chad, who are looking to these global regimes, climate regimes, for not just finance but technologies. But that they, and that they're receiving the technologies that are actually going to help them advance their, for example, renewable energy programs, as opposed to getting technologies that are just simply outdated, which is what's been happening up until now.
And that begins us to get on to the next question that I was going to ask you, actually, which is, what makes climate justice hard to achieve? It, in principle, it sounds like a great thing, but clearly all of you are very concerned that we're not doing well enough on it at the moment. Jessica, do you want to pick this one up?
In my opinion, climate justice is, I think, climate change in itself is a very political issue. And for, I think, since the Earth Summit in 1992, politics has played a very critical role in determining how climate change is addressed, but also how these outcomes play out. And the politics has made sure that there's a complex web of interests, most of which have sought to satisfy the needs of the most powerful within, you know, within groups, but also at international, at national and local levels. And these interests and outcomes aggregate across scales. And so what happens at the international level translates to the national and the local level. And that means that climate justice is very multifaceted. And when, you know, when policies are trying to address climate justice, they always oversimplify the nature of climate justice. And so they overlook this complexity and instead tend to think of climate justice as being linear. For example, when allocating resources to developing countries, there's always the assumption that once you've delivered that finance to this, to these institutions, then that's it. You know, adaptation is solved. There's no more vulnerability. But also, I think the complexity in it is that vulnerability is just not about delivering finance. It's about working with institutions, you know, identifying where the needs are and ensuring that these needs are addressed.
So would I be right to think there are two issues there? One is the issue of in order to achieve fairness, you need to have transfers of money from some places to other places, and getting agreement on those, particularly from the rich countries, may be difficult. And then secondly, there's a whole lot more that you need besides just pushing some money around. There's a lot of additional work that needs also to be done.
Exactly, yeah.
Lauren, do you want to come in on that?
Yes, yeah, so I see this essentially that binary that you just explained. There's two issues. And one is that many of these financial components remain discursive. They are talked about and hyped, and you know, this the US is going to give X amount of dollars to the Green Climate Fund, but then the follow through and the allocation doesn't always happen.
Why not?
Because many of these things, these commitments are non-binding. So, you know, this is, it's international development. It's essentially goodwill, right? Especially from these big polluter countries. So I think this fact that it's discursive, it's something that we talk about, it's something that we perform, but the allocation is performed, right? But the actual distribution of capital isn't happening at the rate that we need it to happen to, and the rate that many of the high polluting countries have committed to. And then the other side of that is that oftentimes when distribution of capital and allocation of capital does happen, it comes in these colonial forms where it's not responding to grassroots needs. It's responding to sort of the development industry broadly. And it's not necessarily meeting the needs of local communities who are facing the impacts of climate change. Mm.
Simon.
Yeah, I wanted to add, just because Lauren brought up the Green Climate Fund, the one positive thing that came out of Copenhagen in 2009 was the establishment of this fund. And I'm sorry, but the funds are simply not there. It's all good and well to say that we're going to have $100 billion, but where is it? We've been looking for this for over 10 years now. And that's something to be looking for too in Glasgow as well, is just to demand the money that was pledged, that was promised by these historical emitters.
And this may be an obvious question, but why do they not want to pay? So, you know, you might kind of think climate change is a really terrible thing that's coming down the road, and these countries should be really, really concerned about it, and they should be willing to make their contribution in order to deal with it. Why does that seem not to be the case?
I think, as a first, I think developed countries do not want to accept responsibility. And because they know that, I think, as a first, when you accept responsibility, then you should be accepting liability for it. And so they feel like once we start paying up this money, then we will be sued, we will be taken to court. And that is what they're most scared for. But also it's for, mostly it's for selfish reasons, because they want to maintain the status quo where there's still, you know, there's countries that are still in need of resources and where they can actually exploit these weaknesses within these countries. And so it's more for, you know, it's for selfish reasons, where if the status quo changes, where some countries are able to develop, where they're not being affected by floods or droughts anymore, then they will lose their leverage over these countries.
Mm. Simon?
If I could just add on to that, 100%, Jessica. But we saw, and we saw this in Paris in 2015, we saw that they changed the text just 20 minutes before the adoption of the Paris Agreement, and they changed it to appease the, as far as I'm concerned, to appease the American delegation. And that was, and that text was to protect, literally it says out in the text that they cannot pursue legal action against industry. It's literally spelled out in the text so that there's, because developed countries, they hate finger pointing, and they see, and this is finger pointing, right? This is putting the blame on someone. So they're willing to accept the fact that they're perhaps more capable and have the technologies, but they're not willing to accept the fact that they're historically responsible purely for legal reasons.
Lauren?
And so, not to sidetrack talking about the COP specifically, but what the COP uses the metric of the country, right? The national representation to address climate change, but increasingly so, and Simon just touched on this, is the fact that corporations have a huge impact. I mean, we've long seen corporate sponsorship at the COP, right? Airlines and oil companies sponsoring the actual governmental negotiations. But now, in the last, say, 2 years, even 1 year, we've seen these corporate climate commitments and net zero commitments, and then all these companies and organizations jumping up to respond to corporate climate action. And it's almost as if this discussion going on at the COP between nations is missing out or happening separately. But I think we really just need to recognize, especially as scholars who watch trends in this field, we need to recognize the increasing influence that corporations have over how the world responds to climate change.
And are they also merely talking, or are they also actually doing?
Well, Jeff Bezos over a year ago dedicated $10 billion to address climate change and hasn't allocated a single penny of that yet. Amazon, his company, has donated $2 billion. They are funding a lot of climate tech startups. Microsoft has donated or contributed, earmarked $1 billion, also sort of funding the climate tech space, which is something that I think we need to, I hope, is addressed in Glasgow. The increasing impact and influence of climate tech and geoengineering and technical sort of new untested solutions to climate change.
So before we get onto the joy of Glasgow, let's go back to some of the previous rounds of international climate change negotiations and just think about how well those have done in terms of climate justice. Simon, do you want to start us off on this? If we look back to Kyoto and Paris, what do we see?
Well, hopefully we've seen that we've learned something, but I'm not sure we've learned. I know we haven't learned enough. We've learned something. We learned from Kyoto, Paris, putting Paris in place, a bottom-up kind of approach to how countries are putting in place their climate action is perhaps better than what we saw in Kyoto, where Kyoto, we basically, the international regime said, here are countries, and we're only talking to Annex 1 countries, that's the developed countries, you go away, you need to reach here, which they didn't achieve. Whereas Paris, they said before Paris that you go away and tell us what you can do. And this is why, as we move on to COP26 in Glasgow, this is why 2020 was supposed to be such an important year, because that was the year we were supposed to see ambition ratcheted up in terms of these nationally determined contributions. We're not there yet. We haven't seen it in terms of climate justice. When you're looking, if we go back to the question of climate justice and the vulnerable populations, meaning the vulnerable countries, what we've seen throughout, and this is one of the reasons in 2009, Copenhagen, we saw a lot of anger among the marginalization of countries. And then even in COP 13, I believe in Warsaw, we saw two walkouts by a lot of civil society groups, but also developing countries because of the kind of language that is being used around here. And that is because there's a certain, with this historic responsibility, a lot of the countries, for example, the African group of negotiators, goes into the negotiations with a certain moral legitimacy. But as we've been saying, as Jessica and Lauren have been saying as well, the problem is, it's kind of soft versus hard power here. They go in with these demands and this legitimacy, but they, first of all, being the most vulnerable, they have one of the reasons is they have nothing to mitigate. They're waiting for the developed countries to mitigate because they have nothing to mitigate. And the second, they have nothing. They can't offer finance. So, in terms of fairness, this is why they're demanding this. So, in terms of what we've seen over the past 20, 30 years, we've seen movement, and we've seen some achievements. The fact that we got 196 countries to agree upon any text at all in 2015 is often cited as an achievement, and granted it is, but the reality is it's a framework. It doesn't actually commit countries to action properly, anyway, in my opinion.
Jessica, would you agree with that? You were talking earlier about the importance of power and the distribution of power in all of this. Have we seen power distributed in a way that in any way could promote climate justice?
Not really. I think so. Copenhagen and Kyoto and the Paris Agreement they made very small steps. They laid the groundwork for climate justice, but we're really far from seeing, we're far from seeing actual, progress on what we need for climate justice. And as Simon has said, there's countries that are still holding the whole process to, hostage. And this is likely not, there's no chance of this changing because there's really not much being done to change the power dynamics. And since 1992 to date, we've only seen a few COPs make very significant changes. The most recent one was the one in Copenhagen and then the one in Paris. And that is very slow process. It's almost performative. I mean, we're just having these COPs just for show. And so that means that climate justice at the international level is not changing. It's not occurring at the pace that we need because policies are not changing. There's very little commitments that are being made, but also the commitments that are made are not as significant. They're not to the extent that we need to, you know, to avoid dangerous climate change. And so I think, yeah, my opinion is that the previous COPs and maybe COP26, if we're not careful, may just lay some groundwork, but we're really far off from achieving what we need in relation to climate justice.
Uh-huh. Lauren?
I think it's important to understand how the COPs work and the fact that the countries, the high polluting countries, have much larger delegations and much more capacity. So some of these smaller countries, they might only have two or three experts on their delegation. So that's why they come up with these coalitions like the African Group of Negotiators or the Alliance for Small Island States, so that they have some collective bargaining power. And because the nitty-gritty of looking into these, the negotiation process is agreeing on text. And the nitty-gritty of these texts, I mean, they spent weeks debating the use of should or shall, right? Is that the correct thing that we saw? And was that the words, the language?
It's an important legal distinction, of course.
Right. So, you know, the actual just capacity of countries like the US and China that come with huge delegations of experts and academics and policy experts versus these small island states that, you know, face brain drains and don't often even have universities to train experts. And they're coming with two or three people. And so there's an injustice even in the negotiation structure.
And can Glasgow do any better?
You know, I don't know. And I think one of the issues that we have coming off of a pandemic, hopefully we're coming off of a pandemic in this fall 2021, is that there's been uneven vaccine rollout. So if you are in a high polluting country, you are someone who has enough like social capital to be a delegate of one of these delegations, you know, representative of one of these delegations, you've probably been vaccinated. But in many other countries, the vaccine rollout hasn't even started. So to ask people who may not have been vaccinated to go to a meeting in person in the fall, you know, we're not going to see a lot of people who from these countries that haven't received this public health outreach. And then the other fact is if we do it online, some of these least developed countries don't have the internet capacity to have people participating at a high level. So the injustice throughout the COP process is vast, right? And many of these meetings are held, like Glasgow's an expensive country, just to, you know, meals and lodging and things like that. And that is always an issue at COPs. They try to switch the COPs between the global north and the global south. But, you know, there's always stories about delegations sort of eating popcorn or finding free food around because their budget doesn't allow them, you know, to be in Spain or in Paris, right? These places are really expensive. So I think we also just need to acknowledge that the whole process is uneven.
Simon?
What we saw, in just to echo on that, in COP25 in Madrid, because keep in mind, it was supposed to be held in Brazil, then it was supposed to be held in Chile, and then a month beforehand, it was held in Madrid a month beforehand, which meant that what happened is that we lost a lot of civil society groups that were simply unable to afford to attend a COP in Madrid at last minute, keeping in mind that their finance was all tied up into going to the COP in Chile. And so there was this, that also added to people just not being able to attend. A really good analogy someone said to me once from the Africa Progress panel, which when talking about even the African Group of Negotiators, which is a bloc of 54 countries, even when looking at that with compared to, say, the European Union, in terms of the European Union has a whole section, a wing of people dedicated to negotiating climate strategies, right? The African group does not have that. It technically has that, but it doesn't have that. They have to come a few days beforehand, any COP or any of these intersessionals, so that they can get their strategy straight. And then you're talking 8 to 10 people. And so within that, the analogy was that it's just like bringing a knife to a gunfight, but then they're showing up with tanks. And that's where the injustice lies in the just the format of these negotiations.
Jessica.
What Simon and Lauren mentioned is you know, what they're saying is just, you know, the branch or the stump of the tree, and underlying it is the inequalities in participation in decision making that contribute to the COP. I mean, the COP in Glasgow will be a culmination of months of discussions. The documents will have been created over months of meetings, and even those meetings, even those discussions have an equal representation from different groups. For example, a very good example is, you know, the Green Climate Fund has an egalitarian representation from developed and developing countries, but you still see those capacity gaps. You know, the developed country board members have so much capacity to go through proposals, policy recommendations, but then the developing country representatives will very likely not have that much capacity. But even beyond those international, you know, climate finance mechanisms, we have decision making within countries is usually based in capital cities, or in areas where, you know, in urban areas, and there's some, you know, there's some community-based organizations, civil society organizations that are usually denied access to these spaces. And so even at the COP, there's always underlying, you know, exclusionary processes that make sure that some voices do not get heard, even when they are not at the COP.
Final question, we're almost out of time, but final question, perhaps the hardest one of all, how could we do it better?
Yeah, so I think in order to do things better, well, first, I guess to do things better, I think the first thing is that we need to have that finance in place that will, and that can be actually accessed by these communities and countries that need it the most. The second is we need to take a, hopefully we can learn from COVID-19 pandemic. We can take some sort of take this as a teachable moment so that we can build better in any sort of recovery package, because in order to have a COVID-19 recovery package, it has to take into account climate change in order to address both of these global crises. And the second is that in terms of is allowing and listening to the actors that perhaps we have, we don't. It cannot always be about the European Union and the US and China, although I take the point that the finance needs to come from these more developed countries. But we need to learn and actually listen to the other countries that are perhaps less accessible to these COPs.
Jessica, how would you do things differently?
I think the COP is important, but doing things differently would require us to think about who are we doing this for, and if we have evidence that this is not benefiting those who are vulnerable to climate change, then we need to change our strategy. And then also that involves, you know, scaling down the COP process, ensuring that, you know, voices from the local level, from the household level, actually feed into the COP process, instead of just simply assuming that because we have a delegation from a country such as Bangladesh, then this delegation is actually able to represent everyone in Bangladesh. We need to actually make efforts to make sure that, you know, those delegations do represent those efforts. And I think it's the COP's mandate to make sure that that happens, where there's equal representation from the grassroots up to the international level.
And final word to Lauren.
I would say that these high polluting countries that maintain a lot of power in the COP process, the UN COP process, they need to publicly recognize and own the fact that there is this legacy of extraction and combustion of fossil fuels that is the root of climate change. And that that there is a historical responsibility from the countries that supported and benefited from the growth of extraction and combustion of fossil fuels, right? Let's get right to the science of it, and acknowledge that, right? And not just say, oh, well, we didn't know, in 1850, we didn't know that it would cause this problem, right? So acknowledgement and acceptance of historical responsibility, and also looking beyond the immediate returns and capital growth of development, and saying, like, we understand that a healthy world benefits everyone. It benefits global sustainability. It benefits resiliency. It, you know, having a just and equitable world for, you know, countries who have contributed least to climate change, and people who have contributed least to climate change benefits everyone. And, you know, the capitalists can still make their money and grow, and business can grow. And we know that sustainable or renewable energy is cheap right now, right? So we don't need, I don't know why we maintain this foothold in fossil fuel infrastructure and fossil fuel development. We just got to accept, you know, renewables and sustainability aren't the end. They're actually a new beginning.
Simon wants to get the final word.
So just on that, I just think that, again, if we go back to how to build better, I just want to take Lauren's point and run with it a little bit here. And that is just that we learned in the pandemic and the crisis how to handle a crisis, whether you agree with how it was handled country to country, that's another question. But we've learned that politicians can turn on their head and address a global crisis. It's just that they're not treating the climate change like it is a crisis. So in order to do all of these things that Lauren was just talking about, in order to achieve that 1.5 degree global warming limit that we set in Paris 6 years ago, we need to see ambition increased in all of these countries that are blocking, as Jessica said at the beginning, at blocking kind of action on climate change. We need to improve, not just to see what they're doing, but actually ensure that they're ratcheting up, because right now we're nowhere near keeping global temperatures to 1.5 degrees.
Which, of course, is the fundamental goal that all of this has to be driving towards. That has been such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much. Let's hope that world leaders are listening in to UCL Uncovering Politics and hearing what you've said. And I hope we can have you back back in the autumn when COP26 is actually taking place, and we can find out just how, in fact, these processes have unfolded. But thank you so much to Simon Chinyi, to Lauren Gifford, and to Jessica Omokuti. Next time, we're looking at democracy. What is it? What different forms can it take, and how well is it working today? Remember, to make sure you don't miss out on future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics, all you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Spotify, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Alan Rennick. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.